Hi, I'm Sabrina and he's Marcus.
And we are two of the founders of the Black Trail Runners. You can find us on Instagram at the Black Trail Runners.
We're a community and campaigning group seeking to increase inclusion, participation and representation of Black people in trail running.
If something resonates with you, please let us know and share online.
Also, leave your review on the podcast platform that you selected as it helps our podcast grow. Your support helps to make this podcast possible.
Thank you for downloading this episode. Now, let's head to the conversation.
The Checkpoint is supported by The North Face, whose fundamental mission remains unchanged since 1966, to provide the best gear for their athletes and the modern-day explorer, support the preservation of the outdoors, and inspire a global movement of exploration.
Hi, I'm Phil Young, one of the co-founders of Black Trail Runners, and today I'm here with Sabrina, who you all know and love, chatting to Andrew Alexander King. Now, if you think you're busy, why don't you just sit yourself down and just check yourself for a minute, will you please? When we spoke to Andrew, he was in California, I believe, having just come back from Alaska, and now, judging by his Instagram account, he's somewhere in Africa, and I've got a sneaking suspicion it might involve a surfboard. Now, Andrew is probably one of the most focused people that I know. He uses his running, his surfing, his climbing and meditation to find both inner peace and to try and make the world a better place. Now, full disclosure, I've never met Andrew in real life, only speaking to him on Teams or Zoom or any other of these apps that we use to communicate with people around the world in a pandemic. But I'm sure after listening to this brief interview, you'll agree with me that if you did meet him somewhere in a pub, which he did suggest we do one day, you'll get lost in one of his incredible tales. And it will once again make you feel as though you're not doing enough with your life. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this little conversation that we have. And if you do, why not share it with some of your friends, get them on the podcast. And give Andrew a follow on his Instagram account. I'm sure you'll find lots to make you envious. And for the ladies out there, and the men, he's actually very well honed physically. So I'm sure you'll get some delight there as well. Anyway, without any further ado, here's Andrew. Andrew, so yeah. can you... I mean, I can see a map of the world behind you, but can you paint a picture of where you are exactly, please? Because as far as I'm concerned, you could be next door, but I'm figuring you're not.
almost. You're going to cut out. Very soon, I'll be over on that other side of the pond soon. But I'm actually home in Southern California where I train when I'm not training to head on an expedition for surfing, freediving, or climbing, or volunteering. So I'm actually back home, just got off Denali, 2 weeks ago. And so I'm back now getting, back into training, get ready for the road to Kilimanjaro, which we can talk about. But here in Southern California, saying hi to my family and friends when they come visit, and just talking to my trainers and everyone else and coaches, and getting back to what we plan to do, which is break through the glass ceiling.
I'm in London, when I hear about California, it's suffering some kind of crazy meltdown heat wave. Is that still happening?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It is. We have a heat wave, but for me, since I've lived here for 3 years, it's normal. I think we get it every summer. But the weird thing is we have a drought going on, which is basically pretty scary because we don't have enough water. And that's, most people don't really freak out about it here because they're like, oh, that's every year. But what the significant thing is, when those forest fires do come, we're going to have less water to combat them. Mm. And that is where it's kind of more of that scary versus in, us having to filter out our waters and such. But those forest fires, when they do hit, and that climate change does hit us like that, it will put a pretty big damper on Mother Nature. So that's kind of scary.
I think, but you're not from California, are you? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've moved down there. You're up from further. Am I right in thinking that you're from Michigan, from Detroit?
Yeah, so I was born Detroit. Yeah, I was born in Detroit. So when people ask, I say it. Detroit is where I was born, where I started, moved around after my grandparents adopted me. And we moved around a lot, and I found peace in myself in Hawaii. So Detroit is where I was born into this world. Hawaii is where I found the peace in this world. And now for me, when people ask, I just say, those are the two main places that I feel the most, you know, significant or catalyst in my life. And so, yeah, not from here. I moved here just to be closer to my grandparents in their twilight years 3 years ago. So I was in Boston working there for Lego, and my great-grandmother that recently passed last year got really sick. And so instead of flying back and forth, I just made a decision that I can work for other tech companies and companies in the world, but I only get, you know, one great-grandmother and like one set of grandparents. And I told them when we got out of Detroit that it was about them. So, yeah.
How important is family to you? I had a very close relationship with my grandfather. He died 15 years ago, and it rocked my world, made me kind of change my whole worldview. What is the relationship with your grandparents like? How instrumental have they been in making you the man that you are today?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm gonna have so many good questions with Phil. I'm just excited for this. But I think for me, they're the foundation, because my mom, growing up in Detroit, I never met my dad. I don't know who my dad is. I still love my dad because he brought me into this world. You know, so for me, I hold space for that love. But I had my mom, my great grandmother, my grandmother, my grandfather, my brother, and my uncles and my sister. And so for me, that tribe right there kept me safe and kept me consistent. They knew that I loved school. They knew that I loved to like run outdoors. Like I would run from like living on our block all the way to the inn, and always like try to just beat people and running. And then also having to run from school from like bullies and, you know, violence. And so for them, they kept me very safe, and like they pretty much put that shield around me. So for me, how important family is to me is it's everything, because family isn't just genetic. It's also in climbing, running, and surfing as well. And I've learned from them that what that meant, it's that people that really don't judge you per se, but have the best intentions for you to grow and nurture you as you grow, and really give you the ability to fail forward, then fail backwards and stay there. So my great grandmother that passed away last year, the sad part about it during the pandemic, she was basically the cornerstone of her entire family. And when she transitioned on, it was very hard for all of us to really take that in, because it was at the start of the pandemic. And when she passed, no one could have a funeral for her. And so my grandmother, who was her daughter, who raised me after she adopted me, it was really hard to just see that, like hear her cry, because she's a very strong Black woman. She's been through a lot, and just, it was very heartbreaking. I've seen a lot of bad things in the world, unfortunately. It's a lot of beautiful good things, but it even gets me right now, like hearing that call that day when I was in a meeting, and just hearing that voice really, it broke everything that I thought that I was mentally tough for, because I knew at that moment that I had to grow up. So for me, when that happened, I went from being 32 to like 52 in like no more than 2 weeks. So it's a big thing for me. And so the way that I promised my family is that when she was, you know, cremated, I promised that we'll give her a burial in Denali. So the whole getting up to Denali, everyone's like, you're going to summit and leave your grandma's ashes there. Unfortunately, because of weather, we couldn't do that, but she's now buried on, her ashes are now spread across on the, called the End of the World Ridge on Denali. And it's one of the most beautiful places there. And so now I could say that she came from Detroit. She was a mixed race, you know, Canadian, African-American woman, worked years within the Motor City, like for Ford and other plant companies. And she is now resting at one of the highest and most beautiful mountains in the world.
So there's two things there, Andrew, that I want to pick up. One of them, well, first of all, is that, as you said, Sabrina, you know, the importance of family, right? And from what I understand about Detroit, which is not much, as you said, it's where the cars were made, and as far as I'm concerned, the home of techno music. But that's yeah, thanks.
Right. Thank you. You look the house cat. Thank you.
But other than that, I don't really know too much about Detroit? I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, it has had some troubles, and it sounds to me that your grandparents and your great grandparents must have had to protect you in that environment quite a lot. Can you tell me a little bit about what growing up in a city like Detroit was like for you?
So it was my mom, my grandmother, my uncles, my brother, my great grandmother. That's my tribe. Like, they all protect me in their ways. My mom worked several jobs just to make sure that we got the clothes and food we needed. So for her, like, she was doing way more and giving us like things that, if looking at economically, we shouldn't have had, like getting a Nintendo, getting to play games, getting to play chess. How we got to afford that is because she actually went above and beyond. And this is a woman that really put everything she had into it to make sure that her kids were safe. And growing up in Detroit is, I didn't understand at the time until later on when I visit my grandparents and got to go to summer camps with them and stuff, that people didn't grow up with bars on their windows, because bars are made to keep things in, not to keep things out. And that, when you think about it later on in life, and I was writing this down in poetry, you're getting kids and individuals used to what it feels like to be behind bars. So I grew up with bars on my windows, and I was just already used to it. Now you're thinking that, let's take it a step further. You now live in a very economically deprived environment that is declining because it's transitioning from motor sports. I mean, Motor City and everything. It's now moving globally. And those individuals are now fighting for resources, and it's mostly minorities. And you're already, if you do something, you're already behind bars, and you already know what it feels like when you go behind bars. You're like, this is like a home to me already. So to answer your question, growing up in a place such as Detroit, it came with a pretty interesting way to grow up fast. I remember seeing a gun before the age of 10. Like, I remember seeing a kid pull it out of the starter jacket, and I won't forever forget it, because as soon as I saw a gun, it was my friend and I walking home from school, and the kid was in the same grade as us, just different class, and he just didn't like my friend. And I remember seeing him pull out the gun, and I was just like so afraid, because I was like, A, it's a kid pulling out a gun. He doesn't know the consequence of that. And B, you know, that all it takes is someone just firing that off, and it's end of story. Before I even got out of elementary school, one of my good friends died in a drive-by shooting. And we just went on to school the next day as there's nothing. We lived down the street from a house that was a trap house. If you know what that means, it's a drug house. And so that was two houses down from where I lived. If you went on to the other side of our school, it's just heavily projects. That's it. And then you saw a very gentrificated school that is just mostly it was a Catholic or Christianity school. And you saw pretty much predominantly one race go to that school. And then you saw the other race go to the other school. And I would always walk across and be like, those kids are wearing nice shoes, nice uniforms. You see them getting dropped off by their parents. You see the rest of us all walking to a school right next to the projects that is basically, you know, next, like across the street, like three blocks down from a railroad. So it's growing up in Detroit made you grow up really fast, because you had to look out for yourself, look out for your family, and look out for your care for. And there was a strong possibility that you may have not gotten out. A lot of my friends didn't get out. And unfortunately, you know, they had consequences that they fell into different, you know, habits. Those habits turned into lifestyles, and that lifestyle took their lives or took them to jail. And my grandparents, you know, we didn't have anyone that ever went to college in our entire family tree. And I said I wanted to go to college, and my mom, my grandparents, my uncles, and my brothers and sister made that possible. So it was to answer your question, it was a place where I had to really grow up and understand my environments and surroundings very quickly and learn to observe before actually, you know, contributing. And that's actually translated into when I travel by myself now to climb or be in a different country or place, I'm able to now sit back, really digest what's around me before actually running full speed ahead. And that's probably why I'm so, people say, calm in like really turbulent situations, like, you know, rock climbing or big wave surfing, because like I've seen death at an early age. I've had to like internalize it. But I also ask at the same time to keep moving forward, because if I don't, I know what that consequence is for me, at least. So,
thank you so much for explaining that. I think a lot of the people that listen, you know, we're based in the UK here, and Phil and I were just definitely before we came onto the interview. I live in a small market town, you know, was the only kind of black mixed race person growing up. And when you describe how you are now, when you're in the mountains, when you're surfing, et cetera, et cetera, and having that that maturity that you've had from a very young age in order to deal with those situations. Often I was called a chameleon. Do you kind of almost feel that you in your life have had to be too chameleon-esque?
I think when it comes to chameleon, you know, it's a funny thing because my grandfather said that about my grandmother one day because I was a teenager. We were heading to Egypt. And my grandmother just always knew how to dress for every country we went to. And she's from Detroit, born and raised there. And my grandfather goes like, your grandmother's a chameleon. And this is a guy that has served in the, you know, army for years. And I was like, what? If he's saying that, that must be nuts. I looked at my grandmother and I was like, oh, she's already wrapped in everything, understands the culture. She's not showing any, like, she understood. So to answer your question, you do feel like a chameleon to some degree because when you take in learning how to adapt to a culture, adapt to a situation, and to really transition through it and come out with like the residue of individuals that live, you're passing through it, but you're also getting the residue of those that live through daily and take that knowledge and move forward. To me, I would say, yeah, you can be a chameleon, but now you know how to actually like not just blend in, but contribute when you actually are asked to contribute in a way that's not, you know, narcissistic or just like self-fulfilling or hidden agendas. And mm-hmm. You know, for me, my grandparents really instilled that into me, just, you know, being very truthful and honest in situations you transition to. And it wasn't easy. I'm going to be very honest. And that's why I talk about it now, like with brands or any company, that I'm not going to make a perfect story for you to be woo-ha and seeing it. Like, this is going to be the truth of what many people didn't get to speak on because they're not here anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think about like, this is what made me into what I am. But like, if you're going to do this with other individuals from these parts of the world and live in these environments and these situations, they have similar stories that you can find if you look it up. And so being a chameleon to me is, I would say, you had to do to survive, but you can use it now to like really contribute and really understand individuals as you move into their environments.
Thank you.
Now, I think at this point, it's worth telling our listeners what you actually do, Andrew, because I think we should explain that you've talked about Egypt and you've talked about Denali and then you said something about Kilimanjaro. But let's frame this a little bit so that people don't think you're David Attenborough or something. Although you are kind of a modern day. I think he's retiring soon, so maybe send in your CV. So the reason you were in Denali, as well as that fantastic act of spreading the ashes of a loved one there, is part of a wider mission that you are on. You explain it. You tell us what you're up to, Andrew.
So for me, I've decided climbing. For me,
let's make the distinction between climbing and mountaineering, because this isn't climbing the stairs up to the fourth floor of the flat we're talking about, is it? We're talking about proper up in the atmosphere climbing.
Yeah, altitude past 3,000 meters and above, you're going past that. So, or, you know, past 10,000, 12,000 feet. So that, I would say, again, let's go back when my grandparents adopted me. We moved around, you know, a lot, and I got to go to Hawaii with them, and I got to learn how to surf. So I taught myself how to surf and mountaineer and climb. So I climbed to my first volcano and got to meditate and come down and surf. And that's where I learned that nature isn't judging me for my skin color. I don't have someone like pulling me over because what I look like. No one's trying to kill me or call me something that, you know, is like derogatory. Nature has just given me gifts to let me grow and be, and those summits were makes me reflect. So as I went on to that, went to college, graduated, I kept exploring and climbing around the world. And that privilege at the time, I didn't know when I got to, back to Sabrina's point, as I transitioned into these different countries, I was just going to climb a mountain. And so I get to Taiwan, I'm on to do the Trinity climbs, which is Mount Fuji, Mount Kinabalu, and Mount Jade. And it's called the Trinity Climbs in Southeast. And so I get to Taiwan. I'm going up Mount Jade in this small little mining town. You can take a train, then you take a bus to get there. And I get there, I'm getting some hot chocolate, and there's a woman And she's like, where are you from? And I say, oh, I'm from America. And she's like, oh, I always want to go to America. And me being as ignorant at the time, I didn't really think about it. I said, oh, you should just come. Come on over. It's a great place. But I look around and like, it would take everything for her to get that. You know, for me, I was just like, oh, okay. So this is, at that moment, it hit me that we're all between these worlds. So the Between Worlds Project is something that I've created where self-funded for years, using the resources I get from working my 9-to-5 job in tech to contribute back to these nonprofits in each country that I go to surf, swim, or climb, or dive in. And so over the years, over the 50 plus mountains, I told myself I'm going to stop just climbing to climb and climb to break through that glass ceiling for individuals that are, you know, stifled or suffocating under that glass ceiling. And to give more context to that is we're all lottery tickets in this world. Like, you're never asked like what color, race, gender you want to identify as or who you want to be. You're just given a gift and you're brought out into this world. And so for me, when I thought of that, I said, given where you sit, your economic value in the United States, which I'm happy to be born into, I got lucky by my lottery ticket, but your zip code can determine what school you go to how much money you're going to make later on. And that's where you sit on that glass ceiling and how close you get through it. And depending on what race you look like, you can either be above that glass ceiling, getting oxygen, I call, or resources that contribute to your success, or you can be under it, fighting through to break through that glass ceiling. And so for me, I decided after last year, George Floyd was the last straw, for me at least, and where I decided to say, if I'm going to stand on these mountains, I'm going to stand with humanity on these issues that are dealing with sexism, racism, climate change along the way. And I decided to go ahead and try to climb the 7 highest mountains on the East continent and the 7 highest volcanoes to talk about these issues along the way. So at the end of it, when I'm done with the last mountain, I could sit back and say, this is my story. This is how I broke through the glass ceiling. These are the people that helped me along the way and gave me that oxygen and resources. And it's someone else's turn to take that over and speak on their story and their and how they went ahead and broke through it. And that's why I give an ice axe to each individual within that representing part of the world, along one of these 14 mountains and volcanoes, to represent breaking through the glass ceiling together. And so each one of those ice axes I take, I give to that individual, and that's contribute to it. So Denali was supposed to be for North America. And unfortunately, because of weather, didn't make it. But like I said, when the time is right, I'll go back up, give it another shot, and come home safe and sound. And yeah.
Andrew, what I can't, right, what I can't get my head around, when do you wake up one day and go, I'm going to climb the biggest 7 mountains in the world? Oh, and actually, I'm going to climb, while I'm at it, actually, by the way, I'm going to climb the biggest 7 volcanoes. What? It's beyond me, really. It's beyond me. I mean, the amount of focus and discipline and drive that you must have to do that. And you said you're kind of doing it off your own back at the first time. Mm-hmm. When I spoke to you, you'd said, oh, yeah, I went up to Kilimanjaro in a mm-hmm. pair of boots that you got from Millets or something. How does that work? Just talk me through that process that goes on in your head. I'm fascinated. I'd love to hear the answer to this one.
I would say honestly, so for a very long time, I'm going to say this very bluntly, and I thought about this meditating the other day. When I didn't talk about it, that was probably the most selfish thing I was doing. The reason why I say it was selfish, because I had some insecurities about, do I want to talk about myself? It should be about the nonprofits along the way. And to get back to the genesis of your question, I ran track in college. I ran track for 13 years. So from as a kid to all the way to be a D1 athlete and get scholarships to it. So when it comes, and I growing up in with my grandparents that are a military family, discipline equaled success and freedom for me. And my success was being able to one day take care of my grandparents and family. Mm-hmm. So when I got to that level, and you know, going back to Sabrina's question about Chameleon Island and going through these different countries and regions and understanding people, taking that discipline to contribute to other individuals just made more sense to me. And like taking my ego out of it made more sense to making sure that they had a platform to speak on their issues. Like seeing during 2017, during the Me Too movement, in America, I went over, I was like, I'm going to go see what it's like for a woman, someone that identifies as a woman in a Muslim country. What is it like for them not to have any rights right off the bat? When their lottery ticket says you are in a Muslim country, you have no rights right off the bat. You have to wear X, Y, and Z because of what we've, our religious beliefs are and what we've always been. So I went over to Morocco to climb the highest mountain in Northern Africa. And I volunteered as a gardener at a woman's refuge. And I got to just sit there and just understand what it meant. That broke through my masculinity and opened up my, you know, diversity of what it means now to be in that space and how they come together. But to answer your question, I just wanted to be free, Phil, and be in a place where I didn't feel like I was being hunted. So when I climbed to the top of a mountain, I felt safer than driving the car that, you know, I got to get after getting a master's degree. Like, no, Mother Nature's not going to be like, hey, I'm sending you some boulders down our mountain because I don't like you coming up here. But an individual that I've been pulled over, it's like, how do you afford this car? Why are you asking me how I afford that? So for me, I just wanted to be in a place where I could feel safe and at peace and get to know myself and reflect in that. So I climbed to just really feel that feeling. I surfed to really feel that feeling. I dove to feel that feeling. And I just kept doing it. And I just kept like, okay, I'm going to climb the highest volcano in each ocean. So I did like Mount Reunion Island in the Indian Ocean. I did Mount Pico, Mount Titi, Fuji, Mauna Kea. And I just was like, I like volcanoes. You get to the top, you just meditate and you come down if you have no time and you go surf in the sunset. I was like, that makes sense. So especially in Indonesia.
Are you hearing this, Sabrina?
I am. Yeah, I am.
I was complaining about doing a half marathon next week. I was climbing volcanoes.
Oh man, like it was just fun to me. I just liked it, and it just was really cool to just be in nature and like also connect from a high point to a low point, and then between it, you just see how you evolve. So that's how I got into it. It wasn't ever to be about like, hey, I want to be the first Black guy to do X. It was always about, I want to make sure I'm not the last person in my community to do X.
Yeah.
Ever. That's what it was about for me in my head. And that's why I didn't really talk about my story for a long time. And when George Floyd happened, a lot of my friends were like, hey, Andrew, I think you should speak at a protest about this. And I wasn't going to do it, but then it just happened. And I spoke at LA City Hall in a protest, and that went viral. And then I was like, well, here we are. Yes, I'm going to go forward. And I didn't want to take away from nonprofits because I always felt that, and I still never want to do, because I feel like what they're fighting for is that global bigger check for it. So, yeah.
I love what you said there about the City Hall speech, because I, last year when it was the after the murder of George Floyd and there was a resurgence over here in terms of the BLM movement, I did a speech outside our town hall, and it very much it brought forth a lot of trauma that I'd held within myself and the racist abuse that I had encountered. And someone asked me the other day, what is it I get from trail running? And my response was very, very similar to that which you've given us about mountain climbing. It's that the trails have never made me, unless I've tried to beast myself, feel less than or feel other. Yes, I've been astounded by sheer beauty and mountains that I've tried to run up and run down. But I know that if I put the requisite work in, that my body and my mind will take me to where I want to be. So what I want to talk to you a little bit about is your training, because you don't just ascend a volcano. You don't just, I mean, you can, but it's going to hurt. So what does your training look like in order to do these amazing things?
So for me, the training, and that's a good point. I'm glad you felt that need to like really open up yourself and talk about that, because that is a beautiful way to do it. Like having people hear your story is key, and also that motivates you to keep going. So thank you for doing that on the other side of the pond, because I feel like that's what people should know, that they have that platform for to do that and that space to do it. So when it comes to training for me, though, training to me is to make sure that I can come home. Make sure that I can, you know, one day be that old person. Like I told Phil and now Matt, like I can be that old man in Hawaii walking on the beach being like, Pipeline now has a Black, white, Hispanic, Asian in the finals. And like the women's finals is a rainbow of not just color, but like diversity and such. And I could just be an old man, be like, no one knows who the hell I am. And I'm just going to keep walking down the shore. Training for me gets me there. Training for me makes sure that my niece and nephew and my family, my friends, like such as you, can see and know that we're in this together. So for me, my training is very disciplined. You know, I do a 3-2-1, which is basically 3 days. I do a conditioning at 5 a.m. So that's weightlifting from 5 to 6. Okay. I wake up, I have a coach here, and we do strictly just, we're weightlifting. He's working on certain, I can tell you some stories about how that helped save my life just recently, like this week too. So we're doing like making sure the body is good. Then we're doing, after that, I have a, probably about another training that's isometric. So that's putting the sled on my heart, like my hips and such, making sure I'm working on just isolated muscles in the group. Mm-hmm. So abs, quads completely. And then after that, it's either rock climbing or surfing for another hour to 2 hours. And then there's meditation. That's another part of the training that is then just making sure that my mind is able to now reflect on the day and go through those notes that I have and write them out and really feel how I'm breathing and such. And then a two is usually one of those, you know, to either conditioning or surfing. And then a one is just one of those for the day. And then I do that 6 days a week. And then I take one whole week to do entire, making sure that the body's got a chiropractor, stretching, and it's going back into it. So then when I do get on a mountain, I'm mentally prepared, I'm physically prepared, and I keep stretching all the way through and through. So I'll break it down for Denali. I train up to 25 hours a week. When I'm not getting ready for an expedition, I'm training probably up to 15. And that 15 does include mental as well as yeah, rehab and therapy to go through it. And so training for me is to make sure not to be like I'm a bulky person, but it's to make sure that when that airbag needs to be deployed, it's deployed and I'm able to get back up. That's why I think on Denali, when we're, I'll just say this, I was scared so badly of Windy Corner on Denali. If anyone's ever been on that mountain, here's this, it's one of the most windy parts of Denali. It's where you come around, it's just a bowl. You come through, you go through the polar field, and then you're coming around, and it is basically, you're walking a very, very small, narrow path, and then it's very, just a drop to a crevasses, and it's just pure on wind. And you're carrying a sled with you too. And some days there's wind, or some days there's not. But like if you watch YouTube videos on that, which I did a lot, and they probably petrified me a little bit, I was just like, oh God, I'm gonna have to carry this sled and it's gonna just be flapping around. But what happened was I trained so much with up to 250 pounds pulling a sled, you know, 3 days a week for up to 600 to 1,000 yards, that by the time I got my sled, people were like, oh, we're only putting like, you know, maybe 50 to 60 pounds in that sled, maybe 100 some days. And I was like, what? I've been training with like 250 in it. So when I got to Windy Corner, I'm like walking it like a dog. I'm just like, just dancing. And people are like, what is wrong with you? And I was like, I don't know. It's just, I think it was great. Cause mentally I was already prepared. Physically, I was already prepared. And I just was having a great time. And even on the last day where we had to hike, what 13 miles in 11 hours from one camp all the way back to base camp the entire way, I was having the best time of my life. And everyone's just like, what the hell is wrong with it? And I was just like, yeah, it's a beautiful day. We going. Because my training is super intense that I have to be in it like every day. So like an 11-hour day of me doing slow was something that my body was already conditioned to do.
Yeah.
Because I've been conditioning to do it at the peak for 8 hours some days. Easily. And then some days I'll do a four, which is I climb Mount Baldy here and like at midnight, get to the top around five, watch a sunset, meditate, do some jump roping, come down, conditioning. Then I do like again another isometric, and then I go ahead and do surfing or do underwater like weights, walking back and forth.
It's worth pointing out at this juncture that Andrew is probably the fittest looking man you've ever seen.
I'm glad you said that. Me saying that, I might come up with a bit of a lech.
If this was video, there would be people fainting left, right, and center. let's just say that.
It's all true.
I've seen your Instagram, Andrew.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. My partner would be so happy. I also didn't, for a long time, I had like I don't know. Like, I tell people this, like, I went through, like, you know, puberty didn't hit me until I was in 30s because I have braces on and everything. So I had a lot of there. So it's I'm pretty shy, but I think I appreciate that, my friend. yeah.
He talks about the 3-2-1. And I mean, you know, that level of training, and I'm going to bring it back. That level of training is, you know, I bow down, having just come out of a big mountain training block. It's everything that you've said, the strength and conditioning, the isometric work, you know, the sport work, the mental work is something that I constantly have to remind myself to work on. And I'm really interested in understanding how old you were when you came to meditation and how important that is as part of that training schedule.
So that's a great question, and I'll just dive right into it with it, because for me, a lot of people ask this question. I started meditating a little bit over a decade ago, probably almost 12 years at this point. So I started to ask myself deeper questions internally. What was reflected externally was more of that, those questions when I found who and what I wanted to be and how I carved that out. Because back to the genesis of all this, like going back to Detroit, you know, leaving, you know, being the first person to go to college, graduate, and like show that as a adolescent, I'm growing up to understand like I'm doing this because I love these people. But I didn't ask myself until in my 20s, where I really got into climbing and meditating on volcanoes and such and climbing, like, what did I really love about myself? And that sounds very narcissistic to some degree. And I'm not trying to do that in like that kind of sense. More of like, if I was to transition onto a different part or different body, like, what were my core values? And so for me, I had to really sit down and really build out that space within myself that I know it's safe to ask myself some really hard questions to be accountable. And then I was able to then really understand my mental focus, because your mind is as big or as a closet or as big as the universe. Mm. It's up to you to decide that. And when it comes to training, you're going to hit some walls. You're going to hit some pretty big walls. And like, I try not to show perfection in that sense, because I think when you don't show that, in my per se, you're letting people know that, oh, I have to be perfect to do these 3-2-1 days. And the truth is, there's a lot of days where I've actually cried and almost given up. And those days are probably the best days, and me being like, I hit my PR, because those are the days when I break through. Yeah. And I'm like, that's my breakthrough. My back's going to want to break through it. But in order for me to do that breakthrough, I really had to be honest with myself consistently over time to really understand what that's like. And really, really make sure, like, am I feeling pain? Am I feeling a breakdown? Or do I just need a minute? You know, like, those are the things that I really like, well, okay, if you need a minute, what does that entail? If you need to have a breakdown or like, you know, express yourself, how do you do that where it's not deconstructive to you and the surroundings around you? And that, when I started to really be honest with myself about what that is, then meditation for me was just key. So I was able to really focus on like, how can I put this in words? In my mind, I see like a pool of water, like it's just a pool of water, and I'm looking down at it. But when I'm not honest with myself, there's so many ripples that I can't see myself. So stopping and being calm and sitting there, it calms down. I can be like, okay, now you can see yourself. What do you look like? What are you trying to do? Where do you need to dive into? How do you go down there? How much air do you need? And how do you come back up and transition on? And I ask myself that in so many different moments. Like on Denali, I almost thought I blew out my Achilles, but it wasn't. I was like, okay, you're just aggravated with your Achilles and you just need to sleep. Some days I'm just like this. You just need to go to sleep, dude. I'm like, bye everybody. I love you all, but I need to sleep. You know, like I really appreciate you, but like, I will not be anything. I can't contribute to you. I can't be myself if I do not sleep. And some other days I just need to meditate, where there was a problem outdoors, climbing, rock climbing. I was training. It took me 3 hours to do. And everyone was like, as rock climbers, you yell and scream, right? I'm not a yeller and a screamer. I'm just not. I tried it outdoors and it felt so awkward. I was like, I'm not going to do this. That's not true. So I just said, hey, take me down. Let me sit. Let me meditate. Let me cool down. And then at that point, I got it done. And then I went back again this weekend, did it twice. Had an accident at one point that I could have broken my entire ankles and legs and my tailbone because I fell really far. Mm. And everyone goes, how are you not freaking out right now? And I just said, that's the nature of the sport. You know, I was like, I survived, but like, I just went to the tent, meditated, broke down piece by piece what happened in my mind, take a deep breath and I go like, how do I want to proceed forward? Came back out, roped up and said, let's do it, and got it done. And so the mental aspect is really knowing yourself and saying, am I doing this for an ego purpose? If I'm doing this for me, either way, it's fine. Just be honest with yourself. And the moment you're honest, like that breakthrough comes really easy for you. But if you're forcing it, that ripple effect and that water gets higher, and then you're drowning in these emotions in these moments that you can't get away from anymore. So,
how well do you know yourself, Andrew? I know that lots of people try to, you know, get into that state where they're in tune, not just with their body, but with their surroundings as well. And when you're doing these incredible expeditions, or when you're surfing big waves in life-threatening positions, I should imagine quite often, how close to yourself do you feel?
I feel really close. Like right now in this moment, I know myself a lot, really great. But when I get in this car and drive on the highway, may not know myself right now. But I would say as you evolve through it, I know myself in those moments to know what I need to feel at peace. And I say that because in the sports that I love to do and that make me feel whole, they're very dangerous. And if something does go wrong, I just say this to my family and friends, what everyone knows is that I'm at peace with it. So I've been in a wipeout where I was held down for two waves, and it really pushed me to the point that I had to really like come up for air. And if I didn't know myself well enough to be like, you need to relax, you need to let everything just relax. Cause if I didn't do that, I could have drowned. Mm. So in those moments, or just what I just talked about, where I fell 50 feet and as I'm falling, I'm sitting there in my head being like, all right, spot your landing, breathe, squat, and you're going to land perfectly. If I didn't know myself and I panicked, I could have been an inch away from a rock, hit my back, broken something. And it could have taken me off for the entire day of not climbing and progressing forward. But knowing myself of like who and what I am, and knowing not to freak out when others are expressing themselves, and not holding that against them and being like, this is how you transition on, this is how you digest it. I feel like I know myself to that point. As I evolve, that question is going to be different because the mountains are higher, the waves are higher, you know, the approaches are higher, the dives are deeper. So as I evolve, I think I have to ask myself a question like, who are you at this moment now? What does that look like? And how do you proceed forward? And how do you actually set your benchmark to know how to come back? Because if something does go wrong, I want to make sure that I leave it in a place where I'm at peace. So people know I didn't struggle. I didn't feel afraid. I felt at peace with it, no matter what the consequences is, good or bad.
And do you feel, you know, you explained it very well about, you know, being in that state of peace. Does that allow you to be closer to nature as well? I mean, one of the things that with trail running, like one of the reasons I go trail running is to be outside of the city and to be able to smell and touch. But I sometimes do find the feelings that I'm just actually more interested in the beats in my headphones and or the speed that I'm going at or something like that. And it does actually, I have to take a step back mentally and think, actually, look, there's some beautiful birds, there's some great trees, this is an ancient woodland. You know, just relax a little bit, Phil. Do you get closer when you're in the sea or when you're up a mountain? Do you have the time? I think this is my question. Do you have the time to really experience where you are and to really indulge yourself in that experience?
That's a great question. And I would say, yes, I've learned that's where meditation is a big thing, to know yourself, because on Denali, I was smiling every minute and I was like this. I was like, oh my gosh, it's a diamond, like, you know, diamond dust. And we're like, you know, the wind pushes off when you have your goggles on, and in between the hours of like 2 to 4, because the sun doesn't fully set there, from like 2 to 4 when it's like popping back up, the wind is blowing these like dashes of diamonds, it look like, off of the like, and it's beautiful. And I was like, oh my gosh, I was like this. And then you see like the mist. And so as you're transitioning through, for me now, like over the years, I've learned to really taste even every one of those moments, to like push your palate of what life tastes like to you and define that. So when I'm there, I do feel like I can be with it. When I'm free diving, I'm able to be down with the fish and like lay there and just be very calm. When I'm surfing, I'll just be like on a wave or in a flow of it. And when I'm not doing that, the interesting thing is I actually mess up more because I don't feel connected to it. It's like, it's just like, I feel like I'm with it and complete. But there are days of training, like when I'm on Baldy and like, you know, I have to get up there in 2 hours and get back down and make it to my meeting at like, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning. So I'm like, all right, you have to go meditate and push through it. But I always make time to like take at least a taste of what that day's bringing or that moment's bringing, like the sunset or seeing like Catalina or the islands in the distance. But yeah, like I always say to people, this vessel that we have, which is our body, I think Warren Buffett said it amazingly in a quote. He said, if you get one car your entire life, how do you want to take care of it? And it's your body. Like, how do you want to like change out the oil? How do you want to like split through the gears? So for me, this vessel or this car, when I'm journeying through someplace, I always do take the time to stop and look around, because like I tell people, this life is great and being human is a gift. You know, you may not come back as that. So for me, it's like, when I'm in nature and some of these cool places, some days I just honestly just take it all in and I do cry a little bit. Like in Denali, I was telling my captain or our lead, I was just like, this is so beautiful. And I'm like this, yeah. And I'm like, look at that. She's like, Andrew, we got to go. I'm like, okay, one more photo. Okay, bye. You know, so I always take the time to do that. It's really, really great. So, and give a little bit of that. The photo of on the ridge where we're caching, and everyone like loved this photo. Like you see then like the Denali park behind us in the range. That photo was taken like in 30-mile-per-hour winds. And like the captain, she was like, is this her and I up there before going on the fixed line? She was like, I love you, Yoshi, by the way, just saying, I love you if you hear this, Yoshi. She goes, Andrew, we gotta go. And I was like, okay, just one more photo though. This is so beautiful. I was like, I'm not crying. So to answer your question, I always make time for it, because as much as I want to get back to it in life, life may have other plans for me, good or bad, that may take me away from it. So I do try to appreciate that completely. So
where's the one question you've described that act of just seeing a view or being in an environment or feeling that energy where you've just got to stop and appreciate it and take a selfie or take an image. So far in your journeying, where, and I ask this because I feel it myself, where for you is the place that has felt, I don't know if you're a religious man or spiritual, but has felt the closest place to a heaven or a paradise to date? Can you even name one? I mean, is there?
Man, I would say, honestly, probably, well, I would say recently it would be Denali, because when we did go up there and, you know, spread those ashes, you know, to the team, the Mountaineer team walked us out at like 11 o'clock at night, which is not really night because it's never nighttime there. It's always sun, but it was cloudy that day. And when I got to the edge of the ridge, it was like, oh, I'm going to spread these ashes. As soon as we did it, the clouds opened up, and it sounds so weird, but the clouds opened and everyone was just like, what the hell just happened? And you saw the entire range. And I was like, I guess grandma's happy here. So I would say on a mountain, that's probably it. And I say surfing wise would more than likely be for me would be back in Hawaii, because you can be in the lineup and you turn around and you see this very, very small, beautiful island just sitting there looking at you. And you turn back around and you look out and it's just the biggest blue you've ever seen. And you can now take, there's two things. You're very small. You're smaller than that small island and this big blue, and you're so insignificant. It just makes you be like, you can either impact it greatly or impact it negatively. It's up to you. So for me, I would say those are my two places. And as far as like spirituality and such, I just say to people, like, I'm just grateful to be human. That's it. I don't know. That's just the way to be it. So like getting people outdoors to, you know, experience this for like we talked about, I just want to make sure like the brands I work with, like Black Diamond knows this. They don't try to like make me tell a story that like tries to fit them. They're like, tell your truth. You know, Super Coffee, the same. Like every brand I work with, Sea to Summit, every brand I work with, BZ, they're always just like, tell your story. And I'm like, I tell this because I want people to really selfishly, I want people to have the opportunity and the choice to pick if they want to go outside or not and find themselves. Yeah. So that's it.
It's interesting, Andrew, you're talking about brands, and I'm going to bring up the article that you wrote for, was it Outsiders Business Journal?
Yep. Yeah.
Which, and as we all know, since George Floyd, and Black Lives Matter, there's been a lot of the outdoor brands, or at least some of the outdoor brands, I think acknowledging
the blind spot that they've had for people of color in supporting them or even recognizing them. And your article talks about almost saying no to brands to a certain extent, to say that if you're not going to be in it for the right reasons, you're not willing really to entertain them. Can you talk a little bit on that?
Yeah, and I stand by that statement. That statement got me a lot of people in my DMs and fired up about it. But I stand by that statement on two levels. I stand for it not only for the community that I'm in during this lifetime, which is an African American. I stand by it for athletes as a whole that are going through, those are identifying their genders, those are identifying in disabilities, those are like moving forward to compete and being outdoors and be actually represented and given a platform to speak, not when it's convenient for a brand to be profitable, but when it's connecting humanity to be progressive. And a lot of brands were very quick to be like, let's do something, let's charge on for Black Lives Matter. It is now 2021. And I have sat back and I have watched, and I think I'm grateful for the mentors I had in my corporate career, and I still have my corporate career, that told me, back to Sabrina's point, being a chameleon, you just sit there and watch. Because in action, and this is very cliche, the action will always speak louder than the words, and the consistency of that action will equal to that success over time. You just have to have that compounding interest within it. And just like take your ego out of it and be like, I'm doing this for X, Y, and Z. I may not be here to see this tree grow, but I'm doing it for those individuals who have shade and like to have rest and have representation to think about what they want to do. Certain brands at the time were so quick to say something and post about it. But when you got deeper into it, they were a little bit nervous to take a step forward consistently, because what I heard is, how do we know we're going to do the right thing all the time? No one's going to do the right thing all the time. I'm not going to say the right thing all the time. I'm not going to do the right thing all the time, because that's unrealistic. If you're looking for perfection and not progression, then you're going to be stuck in that moment, and you're going to, and it's going to keep repeating itself. So many brands really struggle with that. And that's what that article was representing, is that if you're going to take someone's story and you're going to post about it and then profit off of it, the least you can do is make sure that that individual is compensated well enough to feel like they can go someplace and build their own platform in case you do not actually stand up your side of the bargain for them on that platform. That's what that was saying. And that's why a lot of people at the time were like, why are you going to go with BD? You do know that like their parent company is a manufacturer. And I was like, I know that entire story. I've researched it. I researched their portfolio. I researched their backlog. The difference that I saw between it wasn't the brand, it was the people that were consistent. So telling a story like we're all doing now, that story that came out, like their team sat down with me and we actually got to tell my story from 770 Asbury Park in Detroit to where I am now. And they didn't try to change it. They didn't dilute it. And that was the bigger difference. Because I've seen other brands do that where they're like, oh, we don't feel comfortable talking about this, but we don't. And I'm like, okay, you don't feel comfortable talking about this. I don't feel comfortable, but you want me to wear your clothes so you can get more money and more people that look like me. And I'm like, that's a fine line that I'm going to cross out of. Because I sat down, I said, like Phil, you know, you talked about earlier, like self-funded, taking out of my savings to give to nonprofits, which I will always do. It wasn't about the monetization. It was more about the movement of progression for humanity issues for me, and who was going to do that the most consistently and not do it just for the safe face and to save like their portfolio. So that article is speaking on like, if you're an African-American dealing with, you know, racism, which you all are dealing with in, like, again, in England, like seeing the soccer players go through that, I was like, okay, cool. Didn't we just have this discussion? And like, I was like, and then you see Lou like get up there and win like the British Grand Prix again. I'm like, okay, didn't we just have this discussion? And it just, I was like, and I'm like looking at it, like Mercedes was like, all right, cool, we're going to set this up. And like, and then I was like, where's Red Bull? Okay, where's McLaren? Like, if you really care about this, as you all said you did, then it should be consistent. And that's the way I look at it with brands that I I am glad to partner with, because like I said to them, and I truly stand by this, when I get to the last mountain on this, and there's what, 40 training mountains and 14 of these seven highest mountains along the way, so there's 54 I'm doing. When I get to that last mountain, I'm done. When that wave's done, I'm like, it's someone else's turn, but like, mark my words, if I can't transition this to someone that can say, you can go to Phil, you can go to Sabrina, you can go to BD, you can go to Super Coffee, I already know they set it up, and they say, they didn't get the same response. I'm like, no, they have it there. We did it together. You built it. The question is, why don't you do it for this individual now? Mm. And that's the question that I really want to push forward and break through the glass ceiling for. Because if one guy is doing this with his savings, or individuals doing this with the savings, and you're a multi-million dollar company, why are you not doing the same, is my question.
So the message to brands then is what, Andrew? What is your message to them for those who do feel uncomfortable or who can't take that step to be brave?
I would say if you do feel uncomfortable, definitely listen more before speaking and acting on it. Actually have more people that you feel that you might say the wrong thing around being there for you to help coach you through it. We're all students of life. So if you feel like you've gotten to a degree, like if you, like Phil knows this, and you know, I say this often, like I will always be coached. Oh, how to be coached, how to be a human, how to be a writer, how to be an athlete, how to be, you know, take care of myself. But when it comes to those brands, bring in people that are very, very passionate and progressive that are going to challenge you to stay accountable to what you do. And trust them as much as you would trust, you know, your internal team there to really make those decisions. And you're going to get it wrong sometimes, but like being wrong isn't the worst thing. Not moving is. Like giving, when you give false hope to individuals, that creates rebellion. That creates what you see, because you tell people that they have a chance, but then you pull it back from them. And that just creates chaos. So I would say to those brands is, really just be consistent and really push yourself to be that version that you truly speak of. Because if you're not for it, then you're not for it. And that's okay. But just be honest and don't come to the party and say like, hey, I'm going to bring some, like, you know, some, you know, salad and some, you know, champagne. And then you show up and you're like, oh, I didn't bring it, but I still want to party with you guys. I'm like, okay. Okay, cool. But I would say the same thing I had told Matt on his when he brought me on, is that when that happened, every brand was like, we need athletes of color and of diversity. And then they like, it's like you're making a pot of stew and you're like, I want carrots. And you run to your garden. You're like, oh, we don't have any carrots. So where we go get, it was like, you never planted the seed and nurtured it. So this is what you're going to get. And so if you really are truly about this, plant the seed, water it like you water your other plants, and give them the same, and watch your portfolio grow, because the more people you impact, the bigger your income is. So, yeah.
Well, let's put it back. What are you up to? What are you up to next? I mean, that was pretty heavy. That was great. I mean, you're dropping knowledge, aren't you? Again,
yes. I feel bad because I'm supposed to be asking questions too, and I'm just in here like, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sorry, so, yeah. Sorry, if it's too heavy, you know, I didn't,
oh, it's,
you know,
good. Just, this yeah, is good yeah. stuff.
People need to yeah. know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say for me, what's up to next is the road to Kilimanjaro. So every, unfortunately enough, with COVID happening and such, I've decided to do 4 volcanoes, 3 mountains, and 2 big wave surfing globally in the next 5 months. But along the way, it's sticking to the Between More core values is to hopefully leave a place better than when I found it, learn more, open myself up, be educated on issues. So the issues, and we're going to just probably, I think we're coming out with it today. It's going to be, yeah, I think it's 8 countries. So basically going to Senegal, into Africa, starting it off. And hopefully if Rhonda's there, love you, Rhonda, for Black Girls Surf, learn to surf and volunteer with them. And then I'll move on to Morocco, hopefully, then go back to that orphan or that refuge, work there, climb the highest mountain in Northern Africa, surf, then head to Egypt, talk about what it is to have pollution in the Nile River, which a lot of, sometimes people go to Cairo and really don't know that that river has a huge dense population, but it's also the one of the most polluted. And so there is not a lot of fresh water there. Then free dive in Egypt, head to Mount Titi and climb Mount Titi, do mountain climbing and do some rock climbing over there. And then head back, head to Ecuador, Cotopaxi, head down to a nonprofit that I promised that I would bring supplies to right before the pandemic hit, but I wasn't able to get down there. Hang out with them in the cloud forest, talk about that. Head back home to Hawaii, surf, and then head to Kenya to climb Mount Kenya, and then Tanzania to end it off the road to Kilimanjaro.
Wow.
So that is like, it's again, anyone hearing this, it's with COVID, it's up in the air because it's not like in the past. It's very logistical and, you know, having to be, you know, someone that has got the vaccination, I still go through the normal protocol. I don't want to impact people negatively in those places. That defeats the purpose of this, but ending the year at on the top of Kilimanjaro, with the team that I climbed it with the first time, giving, you know, hopefully to bring some resources to them, and also working with the orphanage there that I volunteered at last time when I was there. So that is what I'm up to. It's a lot. The training is not as intense as the gnarly, but it is for the next 5 months, what I'll be doing. And the road to Kilimanjaro is basically to show that these are issues that globally impact us, but we're all connected by. Like, again, if we were to break it down, like the lack of representation of women of color in surfing translates to the Olympics, the lack of, you know, representation or rights for women in one country actually spills over to another. The lack of fresh water in one country impacts others. The lack of the climate change and immigration issues that are happening in the Canary Islands impact others. The cloud forests, lack of rain and the deforestation, and then Mauna Kea as well, and then Tanzania and Kenya as well, talking about child labor abuse. So,
wow. Wow.
And you've got so much energy. I mean, I can feel you may well be in California, Andrew, but I can feel the energy in South London.
Right? Oh, cool. Right now. I was like, Phil, if this doesn't work this week, I will be over there in 3 years. Yeah. So I was like, I'm just going to be like, do you want to go down to the pub and just do this? You want to talk? Yeah. That's what I was sitting there, if it doesn't work, it's cool. But I hope that all works out the road to Kilimanjaro. I would say this for anyone. It's not about the summit, because the summit only shows a reflection of the journey of who you are. It's more about learning from those individuals. So like when I get to the summit, hopefully, and it's right with the people, that I can sit there and be like, we did this and we're standing on these issues together. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think about. So it's not, if it doesn't work out in some of these countries because of like logistical issues and such, and like I'm fine with that, because I just want to make sure that people know that you can go to these places, learn from these people, and grow as a human being and help them grow as well. So that happens.
And for those of us who want to follow this journey, Andrew, where do we check that out?
I'm usually on Instagram. Andrew Alexander King on Instagram, and then I think I'll do a YouTube series at some point. I think that's the plan of it.
We will stick that in the show notes.
And when are you coming to the UK? Do you have any plans to come to the UK? Can I climb?
Yes. Yes.
Can
yes,
I climb and climb with you?
Yes. We're going to run. Yeah, we're going to go for a run. We're all going for a run. I already said this.
Like, are you running these days? I have seen pictures of you running these days. I mean, I know you were a track athlete, weren't you? You were a good track athlete. Are you still mm-hmm. got the running shoes?
I always have my running shoes. I save my knees for the mountains. So I do a lot of like stationary biking now mm-hmm. to save the knees for the mountains. But like, honestly, I'm slow down for running. If you want to do, I run in the sand. I run on the side. Like, I still got it. I'm not sprinting anymore, though. I am retired from sprinting. I am done. But I will do longer distance with you for sure. So I'm down to do a trail run out there. Just when you're able to let me in to your country, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, the quicker we can get into our country, the better for humankind here in the UK.
Yeah, I'm down. We should do it. I'm open for it. I think after I could, let's discuss it, but I'll be over in that way. But I think it'll be cool to collaborate on that, because I at the end of the day, like I said, the platforms we're making like together and having this conversation, which I'm really grateful for, is, you know, anyone hearing this is you're better, again, cliche to say this, but like, yeah, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I've learned that the entire way. Like Phil and I talked in Mexico when I was at Puerto Escondido, and I was sitting there like, and I didn't know, I've known of Phil. And then I was just like, he got me connected with Matt. And like, I am always going to be grateful for that, because I will never forget sitting outside on a really crappy internet and being like, hey, I know you don't know me. I'm not a weirdo. This is what I'm trying to do. And it seems massive, but at the same time, you've helped me progress. And I would love to come over there and run with you and like do the same. So
I think we can get a crew together
easily. Absolutely.
Andrew, so you just let us know and we'll be ready. But look, thank you so much for your time. I know, and I think everyone who's listening to this knows what a busy schedule you must have. So we appreciate you taking a small amount of time on a Tuesday morning, I think it is over there still, for us and Black Trail Runners. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Stay safe. And don't stop doing the work you're doing. I look up to it. And anything else, we're going to run together. It's going to happen. Yes.
It's going to happen. It's happening. You heard it here first.
Thank you for joining us at The Checkpoint.
If you've enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe and share online.
Also, please remember to leave your review on the podcast platform that you selected, as it really helps our podcast to grow.
Your support helps make this podcast possible.
Remember, if you have any questions, get in touch with us via our Instagram page at Black Trail Runners, or if you want to join our community, please search Facebook for Black Trail Runners and connect with us.